White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 287.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear to the top.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast and the Game of Thrones White Rocket Podcast. It might as well be its own thing now, like all our other separate shows. Brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and by people like you, our great patrons at patreon.com. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and because it's Game of Thrones week again, I'm joined, as always, by my Game of Thrones co-host, John Ringer. Welcome back aboard, John.
Thanks for having me, Van.
Really looking forward to talking about the last three episodes, because as John and I were just trying to refresh our memories, we did a big show about the first episode. We weren't going to talk again until tonight, but after the second episode, we had a couple of minutes, and I was like, we've got to do it, after that second episode was so big. So we've talked about the second one, but we haven't talked about 3, 4, or 5. And 5 is the one that just aired last night as we're recording this on Monday after Sunday's East Watch. I believe it's East Watch by the Sea, but the episode was called East Watch. So let's go ahead and start digging on in, because we have a lot to cover. But first, of course, I have to point out that we always welcome contact from our listeners. We welcome questions and comments and other things. You can use our sports show email for now until I get one set up for this show. Just you can email auwishbone@gmail.com, auwishbone@gmail.com, or you can tweet at Van Allen Plexico or at JK Ringer. And I also want to point out that we can always appreciate if you leave us a good review or a rating at least on iTunes. The show is supposed to be on Google Play now, but I haven't gotten a confirmation yet that it is. The Wishbone show went up on Google Play within like a day, but I'm still they must not think as highly of this show as they do of the Wishbone. But anyway, I'm sorry. There's one other thing. I'm sorry, John, but there's a couple other business things to tidy up front. And that is, as I've been pointing out, and I just want to make sure everybody knows it, we're no longer part of our old network. We now have our own network. As you've seen this coming for the last several months, we are the White Rocket Entertainment Network. And you find all of our shows there on iTunes and on Podbean under White Rocket Entertainment. What that means is, because we don't have anybody else helping us to get the word out now, we need you, our listeners, to either help financially through patreon.com as little as a dollar a month, or we could appreciate if you would spread the word to your friends and other folks that might be interested either in our shows on this channel or the AU Wishbone. All right, John, it is season 7 of Game of Thrones. We've watched 3 episodes since we last chatted. We got a lot to talk about. How do you feel about, with 2 episodes to go, how do you feel about season 7 as it stands right now?
Excited. Season 7's been great.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been a lot of moments of season 7 where as a fan, you know, you were excited. You wanted to cheer. You were going, ah! So it's been a really, really good season so far.
That's the exact noise I was making. I think that the main thing is that we're past the books. And so I do understand that some people have criticisms that it's too rushed or going too fast, or maybe this is more of a, I've heard it called a fan fiction approach to the story now, because they're kind of making it up as they go along. Although theoretically with some input from George R. R. Martin. But I got to say, all that aside, what I'm enjoying is not knowing what's going to happen.
I don't enjoy that. I really liked when I knew what was going to happen with the books, and I didn't have to worry about characters I cared about every second they're on the screen, and now I do.
You're off the map. You're wandering in uncharted territories.
I am.
You're afraid you're going to run into some Dothraki out there in the grasslands.
I am worried about that.
But I mean, I love it, though, because, I mean, some of my favorite movies and TV shows have been based on books that I'd already read. And so as much as I loved them, like The Lord of the Rings, I mean, as much as I dearly, dearly love The Lord of the Rings movies, I knew almost everything that was going to happen. Unless PJ, you know, went off on some tangent that wasn't in the books, I knew everything that was going to happen. So my love of those movies was always tempered by the fact that there were no surprises. Whereas, mm-hmm. and the first several seasons of this show, it was the same thing. I'm like, yeah, The Red Wedding, wow, they did a really good job with it, but it wasn't a surprise to me at all, you know. Whereas now I'm like, ooh, look at that. Who saw that coming, you know. So, but let me ask you this. You know, some people have, and I think somewhat fairly said, it's rushed. But, I mean, because think about it. If they were still going entirely on George R.R. Martin novels to do this, there would be like at least, you know, three more seasons to go. Because think about it, it took them two seasons just to adapt Storm of Swords, the third book. And if Winds of Winter is going to be as long as I think it is, then it could have taken them two seasons just to get up to the next to last, you know, through the next to last book. So, in other words, I think if Martin were writing this, it would be dragging out much longer and they would need more seasons to cover everything, or they would just be leaving stuff out that they wouldn't have left out the first four, five seasons, and we would have pretty much what we're having now anyway. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're right. I think if they had the full books, they might go longer. But it's also, I appreciate the fact that they shortened the length of the seasons in order to be able to spend more money on the CGI and the budget for some of these episodes. And you can tell the difference.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, if you watch one of these episodes, go back and watch something from season one or season two, there's a dramatic difference in the scale of money they are spending. And so I appreciate that because we need it at this point. But you're right. Maybe it would go out longer if the books were there.
Well, it's every episode seems to some degree like a somewhat major motion picture right now. And that's amazing for television. Now, to be fair, the most recent episode, which we'll get into in just a minute, the most recent episode, there wasn't the big set piece like we've gotten in several this season. In fact, we were kind of getting spoiled, wouldn't you say, that
We did get spoiled because I was disappointed at the end of the most recent episode that there wasn't one. But
yeah.
I think with this season, there are two kinds of episodes. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, the big budget spectacle episodes, and there's the moving the pieces around the board episode.
Yes.
And this last episode was a moving of pieces around the board episode.
I think the first one kind of was too, right?
Yes. And the first one was, you know, the same thing, moving the pieces around the board, remembering where everybody is and moving everybody to new places. And this is the same. It's, you know, this was getting people going to new places. So then when we come back, we can have the big action scene.
Yeah. Yeah, and I get the sense that because, you know, the tradition seems to be that the next to last or penultimate episode of each season is the one that has the big blowout, like the Battle of the Bastards or the Battle of Blackwater or, you know, whatever, or the Red Wedding or whatever. That's kind of become the tradition that they do the real blowout in the next to last episode and then kind of pick up the pieces in the last episode. And that means that we are just 6 days away, potentially, from the big blowout episode of this season, and I suspect it will involve the White Walkers and some serious snow battles going on. I mean, we may not see the Imperial AT-AT Walkers, but we're going to have a heck of a snow battle. We're going to have a heck of a snow battle. Somebody needs to do a mashup where, like, the Empire lands on Hoth and is advancing with the Walkers, and then you flip around and see the White Walker zombies coming, and you see them coming on each other. That would be awesome. There's you a mashup, man. That's what I want to see. The ultimate snow battle. Okay, so I wasn't sure going in how you wanted to structure this. Did you want to talk about each episode separately or just kind of talk about them based on character arcs altogether?
I wanted to talk about character arcs over the course of the three episodes.
Okay, and obviously we'll certainly emphasize the most recent one for folks that are just kind of tuning in to get the latest. But you haven't heard, you folks out there haven't heard us talk about any of these three really, other than maybe on Twitter a little bit. So yeah, we're gonna kind of look at each character and their arc over the last three episodes or so, and maybe even touch back a little earlier if we need context. So, all right, well, let's dig into that then. We're going to go 3 through 5. You had a note here about leaks before we go further. Are you part of the White House now and you're looking for leaks or what? What's up with that? Are you the plumber from Watergate?
No, but I just wanted to be clear with everybody that my view on this is the same as, you know, some other podcasts and stuff where I read about Game of Thrones. I don't want to know. Like,
no.
I'm fine with reading stuff in the books and reading, you know, and trying to figure out theories and stuff from watching the show and reading the books. But if there's like, you know, this hack at HBO and episodes that were leaked, I don't want to know. I don't want to know anything about it. I don't want to watch it. And I just want to watch it when it comes. And so that's my view on it for this purposes of this podcast. And I don't want to know any spoilers that are based on leaked information.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I haven't even fully understood that whole story, because as soon as I started hearing about it, I just tuned it out. Not only do I not want to know the information, I don't even want to know about it. You know, so I don't know anything about it. I was afraid if I went to look for what it was about, I would find the stuff. You know what I mean? And I don't want to see the stuff. So we're good. All right. Okay. So first up, I guess we have the Dragon Queen, Daenerys, or Daenerys, however you want to pronounce it. And it's been interesting over the last three episodes to see how her arc has carried her in regard to what she expects of others, I think, and what she expects of her friends and allies, and then people like Jon, who are kind of in a gray area still. So let me set that up, and then we'll get your thoughts on it, that at the beginning of episode 3, The Queen's Justice, Jon arrived at Dragonstone, and she stuck to the company line of bend the knee, right? He doesn't want to bend the knee, so I want your thoughts first. What do you think about Dany's attitude toward Jon, at least for the first two-thirds of their relationship now? And then what do you think about Jon's stance that he will not, under any circumstances, bend the knee to her? He wants to kind of treat with her as equals. What do you think about each of where they're coming from on that?
I mean, I think Dany's stance is Jon or anybody else bend the knee. Mm-hmm. There's like, in her view, people that oppose her, it's bend the knee or die. We saw that in the most recent episode. And so she's not willing to negotiate to give away parts of her kingdom that she's getting ready to fight and to win. So I understand it from that perspective. But at the same time, I understand Jon's perspective, because his people chose him to be the king in the North, and mainly because of his leadership skills and his, you know, desire to protect them and his understanding of this threat that's coming. And if he, you know, bent the knee and then Daenerys said, okay, bring your army south to fight Cersei, he would be sworn obligated to do that. And that would be wrong. I think he couldn't do that. I think he's singularly focused on this threat to humanity, and he's not going to hand over the, you know, control of that to anybody unless he's sure that they see the threat the same way he does.
Well, you know, when she says to him, basically, I'm here not to turn the wheel again, I'm here to break the wheel. And then she turns around and says, bend the knee and I'll make you warden of the North. If I were Jon, I'm like, that sounds like the same old wheel to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not hearing from her, you know, her selling point was everybody loves me because I'm so merciful and revolutionary and different and everything. Tyrion's pointed this out. He's about the only one that can get away with it. That, you know, and yet she's basically playing. As soon as she set foot on Westeros, she reverted to being just another claimant from the Clash of Kings. You know, I mean, it's like she was all this and that in Easteros or Essos, and then she gets here and it's right.
No,
back to,
I think she has conducted herself differently so far.
Well, she didn't burn everybody until recently. That's true.
And outside of battle, she's burned two people.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what she hasn't done, for example, is turn the Dothraki loose on the countryside.
Well, that's what I'm saying. She hasn't, gone full bore against the people like others.
But that's kind of the thing that Tywin Lannister did with his guys. So she hasn't gone there. And I think that's the difference between her and those people.
Yeah. I know. I still feel like her approach was supposed to be different. And I'm kind of disappointed. Now, in a minute, we're going to talk about what she did with the two guys, with the Tarly, Sam's brother and dad. We'll get to that. But in terms of how she's been acting as, like, I'm the queen, bow to me, take the knee, I just feel like she's regressed a little bit there. And after everything she went through in Essos, I can see where she's impatient, you know?
But, well, I think it's not just that. I think she also feels like she has the dragon. She has a big army. She's probably going to win. Therefore, why should she negotiate and give away the country?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that rolls us nicely into the next point, which is for the first couple episodes there, she wasn't winning. She was losing at every turn. And, I mean, she was on the brink of going from... I mean, let's use a football analogy for a minute. She was like, you know, Nebraska or Ohio State coming into a game against Louisiana Monroe and fumbling the first three times she had the ball. Louisiana Monroe stuck it in the end zones, up 21-0 in the first quarter. Now, it's just the first quarter, but dang, you know, you've dug yourself a pretty big hole right off the kickoff. You know what I mean?
Well, and that's a good analogy because – coming into the season, she was the big favorite. She has the dragon. She has the Dothraki. She has the Unsullied. She has advisors who know Westeros. You know, they took Dragonstone without a fight. And so she had the big navy going into the season. So she, you know, she had Highgarden and Dorne as allies. So she was the overwhelming favorite. So it is a good analogy where the other side kind of, you know, ran it a trick play or two and got some turnovers and scored to go up early. But in the long run, you would still bet on the team, you know, the better team.
Well, let's think about some of her losses real quick. She lost Sunspear. What's the Dorne?
Dorne.
That's pretty much done, right? I mean, they've still got an army, but they haven't. They're decapitated. They have no leadership. She lost her navy completely. The Unsullied. Yes. Where are the Unsullied? They're still over at Castle Rock just twiddling their thumbs, right? Because nobody cares.
I believe they are marching from Castle Rock towards the other side of the continent.
Okay. But the fear there was that Jaime would descend on them halfway, right? And do like the Cossacks against Napoleon in Russia, like just gnaw at them from the sides until like five guys make it across the country?
I mean, I think they're worried, but also I think a lot of it is it's going to take them a couple of weeks to march across there, and they're kind of out of the picture until then.
Yeah.
So the idea is, can you defeat the rest of, can they get, the, I think the idea for Jaime and Cersei was, can you get these other things done, you know, take Highgarden, get the gold, get the food, get it back into King's Landing, and improve your position before they get back into the picture.
So when Dany finally does lay siege, I'm assuming at some point, to King's Landing, to the Red Keep, will the Unsullied show up like Rohan at the end of Return of the King?
I think they'll have to be there at the beginning, because I don't think the Dothraki could do a siege worth their crap.
Now, yeah, that's the funny thing. The Dothraki in open land are fearsome. Nobody can stand against them. Jaime mentioned that this week.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you get behind a stone wall, the Dothraki are like, ugh, stone am frightening. Me go elsewhere and graze, you know?
That's right. So I think, if she's going to take King's Landing, it has to be the Unsullied.
Well, they did a pretty good job on Castle Rock.
Well, and that's why she needed Dorne and Highgarden so bad, because they had Westerosi armies that could come help with that.
So, so after several setbacks that we mentioned, and as Elrond would put it, our list of allies grows thin, she then said, screw it, I'm tired of listening to you people, I've got a dragon. And so she takes off, and there's what's affectionately called the Loot Train Battle, which I think is a misnomer, because as we discovered pretty quickly, it wasn't actually the Loot Train. It was like the hay train, right? The loot was already in the bank.
It was the food train.
It was the food train. She basically burned up a bunch of bread trucks, Wonder Bread delivery trucks.
Mm-hmm.
While the money was safe in it. So Cersei did get the money, right?
My understanding is that she got the money and she gave it to the bank.
So it's in King's Landing, and it went to the Iron Bank and to Mycroft Holmes. I think it's kind of cool that the Iron Bank's representative is Sherlock Holmes' brother. He always plays some agent who knows more than anybody else.
But the other part is, because Cersei lost the food and a lot of her army, she's going to have to turn around and borrow money again to buy food to get through the winter and to hire mercenaries.
So it hasn't been clear how many soldiers she lost, because if you'd ask me immediately after the Loot Train Battle, we'll just call it that because that's what everybody calls it. If you'd ask me right after that episode when Jaime plunged into the water and it goes fade to black, which, by the way, apparently Bronn has an outboard motor in his pants, but we'll get to that. If you'd ask me at the end of that fourth episode how much of Cersei's army was destroyed by that battle, I would have said 10%, 15% maybe. But in last night's episode, episode 5, Eastwatch, she sounded like they'd lost most of their army. We're going to have to go hire mercenaries just to have an army.
No, I think they lost most of their army. I mean, again, they didn't have that. All they have were the actual Lannister field troops. I mean, they don't have, or soldiers from anywhere else left, because they drove all their other allies away.
Or killed them.
And they've been fighting for years at this point. So I don't think their army was gigantic. So it was their forces and whatever the Tarleys brought. And I think they lost a good chunk of those guys.
Yeah, they sure. Well, it was kind of hard to tell, because we had cavalry charges and aerial close air support. But we never really had like a strategic view, like if it was a risk board, which I would have appreciated, just to kind of get a sense of how many. I wish we had an order of battle for that battle that just kind of listed how many troops on each side, and how many whatever, but how many scorpions did they have? I mean, did they burn them up, or did Dany capture did they have like five scorpions in that train, or just the one? If they had five and she burned up one, did they now have four of their own? They could shoot during a siege or something. That I don't know if that'd come in handy, but maybe. I don't know. While we're talking about the Loot Train Battle, because we don't really have a particular category just for Jaime picks up a spear and charges like a knight against a winged and wounded Drogon, right?
Yes.
And by the way, one of my friends on Twitter was saying, is Drogon going to be dead? I said, I think he's just going to go on the physically unable to perform list for a little while and rehab. I could just see Drogon in the room icing it down and, working it out, lifting some weights, and doing the stationary dragon bicycle, and getting back in the game.
Oh, yeah, he's on the 5-day DL or whatever. It's not anything big.
He's all right. It just kind of poked him in the wing and made him – he couldn't fly because it was hurting him. That's why she was pulling it out. I figure once she got it out, he's probably all right. So he's okay, unless he develops some kind of an infection. Maybe they should have used germ warfare on their scorpion arrow bolts. So Jaime charges them, and Drogon's going to light, going to make Jaime barbecue, and somebody knocks him in the water. Okay, we see at the beginning of the most recent episode, it was Bronn. And they come out of the water like miles from the battle. What did you make of that?
I was very angry about that, honestly. I mean, not just the fact that he didn't swim all that way underwater, okay? I don't care if it was the one of the swiftest currents in the world or whatever in that river. They didn't. But also, where's the Dothraki? Where's your security? Like, you did all the, I mean, there's nobody riding around making sure no Lannister reinforcements show up. Like, and also, like, you saw him fall in the water.
Yeah.
He's a valuable piece. Like, I'd have had 10 Dothraki guys swimming in there, bringing him back dead or alive.
Yeah.
So that part made me mad, honestly.
I think we can just chalk it up to it was contrived on the grounds that we needed Jaime to get away. Bronn, too, to a certain degree, although I think Bronn would have been okay with... I mean, he'd have bent the knee, wouldn't he? Danny would have said, everybody been...
Bronn's not proud.
He would have gotten like... She would have gotten like, bend, and he's already down. Like, yes, Your Majesty, he's you
like,
got it.
He's like, everybody down.
Everybody down. We're good. We're all down. We're good here, ma'am. But yeah, they needed Jaime to get away, and Jaime would have never gotten away.
Because Jaime would not have bent the knee.
No. And she wouldn't... I mean, you know... Well, it would have also been extremely uncomfortable because Tyrion would have been trying to save his life. But that would have been touchy for Tyrion because that would bring up the whole, are you sure you're loyal to me and not your family argument all over again that Tyrion already had to deal with her. You know what I mean?
And Tyrion owes Jaime for the escape, and Tyrion probably would have had to spring him.
Yeah. And then that would have been it. And then Danny would have been like, I knew you cared more about your family than me. You're a liar. Give me back my little hand pin.
And I'm going to feed you the dragon.
Yeah. You're an hors d'oeuvre. That was poor. So, I'm sorry. But, yeah, I mean, basically, you had to end that scene or start the next episode scene with Jaime getting away, because it would have been existentially catastrophic for everybody if she'd captured him.
That's right.
I mean, at that point, better that he's just not even there. But if he's not there, Bronn's not there. And if Bronn's not there, then you got a problem with who's firing the scorpion and who's doing all the stuff. And yeah. So they needed Jaime and Bronn in that loot train. But they also needed to make sure they both got away safely afterward. And especially because then you turn around and have Jaime back in King's Landing where he can meet with Tyrion, which we'll get to again and we'll push down the road. Okay, so last couple of things about Dany. Because I got another couple of things I want to say about Dany, but I'm going to roll them into the John section coming up. So a couple of things. One is that she... We've touched on this a little bit already. I think that the burning of the two prisoners was the most visible and visceral of the things she's done in this whole campaign that the producers have been running of, look out, she's the Mad Queen, look out. I mean, they're basically hitting us over the head with this, oh, she's the Mad Queen, everybody knows it, right? They even had Varys talking with Tyrion about it. Was it this episode or last week? I can't remember.
It was this episode.
Yeah.
And I thought Varys made good points.
Well, yeah. Which side was he on? I can't, because Tyrion's
he
one
was
that
at the, I told myself it wasn't my fault as they screamed and burned.
Yeah. But see, I disagree with both of them. I think they're both worry warts and getting their pants in a wad for no reason because I'm firmly on Danny's side there. She gave him every opportunity to change sides. She even gave them the opportunity to take the black, which is more opportunity than their crowd gave Ned. They told him they were going to let him do that, but then they didn't, right? They pulled it away.
And that was just Joffrey being an idiot. And a lot of the other war that's happened, people take prisoners. She is not interested in prisoners.
No. So, I mean, she gave him two options. Well, three. She gave him three options. One, join my side. Well, I can't do that. Okay. Two, go up to the wall, help defend the realm against these ice zombies. No, I'm not doing that either. All right. Well, option number three is you're dead. I'm sorry, right? I mean, it's like, it reminds me of Alec Baldwin in Glengarry Glen Ross. First prize is a Cadillac. Second prize is a set of steak knives. Third prize, you're fired.
I get it. I do worry about her because her gut reaction when things go bad is, that's it, I'm burning the city.
Well, her gut reaction with everything is to use the dragons.
Yes. Well, I mean, how many times has she said, I'm flying to King's Landing and I'm burning the place to the ground? Mm. I mean, that's what she wants to do.
Yes.
So it's not unreasonable to say, you know, we're a little worried about her and the burning thing.
Well, I think it's just because she's got essentially tactical nuclear weapons, and you're not living in a world where anybody else has got nukes. She has a monopoly on nuclear weapons. She doesn't have
to worry.
She
seems a little eager to throw them.
She doesn't have to worry about the Soviet Union and a mutually assured destruction and any of that. She can unleash her nuclear, and they're renewable. She has renewable nukes, and she has a monopoly on them. You don't think that the temptation is strong on anybody to employ your best weapon and save the lives of your own people? It's like Truman dropping the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
There's two things here. One, this goes back to what you were saying a minute ago about you thought she was different. And yeah. If she's different, she doesn't do that. If she's different, she doesn't nuke the little people.
Well, she tried it that
the big people.
She tried it that way, and it wasn't working out.
But she still hasn't done that.
Think about
she still hasn't nuked the little people.
No, but I'm not saying nuke the little people.
But that's what would happen if she went to King's Landing with the dragons. She would burn the city.
I think she just burned down the Red Keep.
I think there'd be a lot of other
collateral
people
damage.
I mean, it would be like when the church went down. A lot of other people died there too. So
it's not a low. It's not a low yield second, bomb. It's a high yield. It's like a 4 megaton.
That's right. And the second part is when you don't give your enemy the chance of surrender and honorably being taken prisoner, then people don't surrender to you. They fight to the death.
So you're making
your enemies fight harder.
That's a good point, unless you point out they could have taken the black.
Well, people don't want to take the black.
Well, it's better than taking the fire.
Death sentence anyhow.
Well, right now they're all facing a death sentence because they won't want to listen to John, but that's a whole other thing. Okay, well, that's interesting, and I'm glad that you felt that way, really, because I wanted an interesting conversation about it, and I've only heard one side, and I've been thinking all along, well, I disagree with people. I really feel like she did, because, see, what I'm thinking of is she has learned she can't show much weakness. I mean, you know, anybody in her position can't show a lot of weakness, but as a young woman in a world where, you know, women are treated and thought of as badly, you know, as they probably are there, as we've seen, they're not empowered. You know what I mean? All that.
Mm-hmm.
She can't let on any weakness. She can't show that she can be wheedled and whined into going, oh, okay, I'll let my enemies live. You boys just scamper on along. You don't have to join my side. You don't have to take the black. And I'm not going to kill you. Just go on back and head on back to King's Landing, and that'll all be well and good.
No, the option is I'm going to send some Dothraki back to Highgarden, and you're going to sit in the dungeon for the rest of this war and eat like rats.
Well, what did Tyrion did say?
Tyrion tried to get her to do that. She has no interest in taking them prisoner.
That's right. He said some time in the black dungeon or whatever he called it. I can't think what they call them. The black
cells.
The black cells can soften somebody's, you know, attitude or whatever. And she's like, not going to do it. That's fair. All right. That's a good point. I forgot that he did raise the point of the imprisonment, and she wasn't interested. I'm still not thinking. See, here's the thing. And this is one of the things that I don't want to get too meta and too much behind the scenes, but here's one of the, I don't want to call it a problem I have with this season. Because it's not really a problem other than just giving us something to argue about, which is good because it's fun. But one of the issues I see with this season is that the seams are showing, the manipulation by the writers is showing. It's the same thing what we were talking about where Jaime and Bronn fall in the water and they come out of the water 10 miles away. It's the contriveness is showing. They're having to contrive things that they wouldn't have done. Things that George R. R. Martin would have spent 300 pages getting around to, they have to contrive to happen in one page on the screen.
I agree. But I think it's also like it's kind of where we are, and that's what they got to do to get to the end.
So. Well, right. So what I'm saying is I feel like they are contriving suspicion about Dany being the crazy mad queen just to give us something to worry about. And I feel like there's an episode coming either in the next two or sometime next season where it's all of a sudden like, oh, no, she's just her good old self again. That was all just a red herring.
The good old self that crucified 300 people.
I get the sense you're not on Dany's side, John.
I'm on Dany's side, but she's not an angel of mercy or anything.
No, she's the mother of dragons.
She's perfectly willing to do the terrible things that need to be done.
I like how they listed her titles and they abbreviated it this time, because usually when she lists her titles, it sounds like the old sultans of the Ottoman Empire where they got like 15 mm-hmm. things. This time they just kind of went, I guess it was Tyrion or whoever, just went Daenerys Targaryen, Mother of Dragons, the Unburnt, and that's it. You know, it wasn't quite what Davos did, where they went through that whole list, and Davos goes, "This is Jon Snow," and he looks at it and he goes, "Oh, he's King of the North." I love that. That was so.
It was
great.
Good. Very understated. Davos has been great this season.
Davos is the man. He is awesome. He's like, don't you want him as like your uncle or your granddad or something?
Yes,
he's been so. Let's go see Uncle Davos and see what he's up to. I love it. I do. I love it. All right. So the last thing then about that, Tyrion and Varys were talking about all this. What do you think is going to happen with that? I mean, we've gone over the space of a couple of episodes from Varys having to prove his loyalty to Dany to now him having to turn right around and be like, I'm not sure if I'm loyal to her. She's crazy.
I mean, he said at the beginning, I'm not, if you do this stuff, I'm not going to be loyal to you.
Yeah, that's true.
So he's, you know, and I think he's, Tyrion has to be the one to rein her in when she has these impulses, like, I'm going to go burn King's Landing to the ground. And that's kind of what Varys is reminding him, that it's on him to keep her from going to the dark side, basically.
Well, shifting gears from Dany, Arya came home. We got a great scene at the beginning of the Spoils of War, the loot train. They should have just called it the loot train, where Arya gets back to Winterfell. And she has a kind of a muted reunion with Sansa because they were never best of friends.
But I thought it was pretty good for them.
It was. It was nice. And she gets to do a little sparring with Brienne, which was cool because you look up and Sansa, I mean, that was just a priceless scene where she's down there like taking it to this giant Amazon warrior woman, and you look up and Sansa's like, holy crap, and Littlefinger's like, well, that's something I hadn't taken into consideration in my thousands of plans. Wah, right? So you see the wheels turning in Littlefinger's head, because the wheels never stop turning in Littlefinger's head. What do you think about the whole situation developing with... Because you saw immediately in the last episode that the Lords of the North are now going to Sansa and saying, you should just take over because Jon's not even here. And then you see Littlefinger talking to them separately, like, you know, way to go, boys. Keep raising them doubts on Jon. I mean, all that Littlefinger needs to do in this season is grow a bigger mustache so he can twirl it while he's tying Jon to the railroad tracks. You know, I mean, my gosh.
Yeah, he has pointed Arya like an arrow at Sansa, and he's just fired it.
Mm-hmm.
He 100% has you know, driven. He's going to drive them apart, and he may screw it up to the point where, you know, he can get something out of this.
Well, tell the folks that don't know, because it went by really fast, what was that paper that he pretended to hide, knowing full well Arya would find it and read it?
Yeah, let's be clear. He was on to Arya the whole time. Arya's great at the killing people and the face thing.
Yeah.
But Littlefinger is the, you know, sneakiest, most underhanded manipulator in the whole kingdom. So he's not fooled by that. the paper that he got and that he pretended to hide and Arya found was the one that Sansa was forced to write when they were threatening to kill Eddard Stark.
Way back in the beginning.
Season one, where she said he was a traitor and
she has traitor blood.
Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. And so it was designed to make Arya dislike her sister more and drive a wedge between them. And it, you know, Arya has no idea what Sansa went through. This is the thing that, you know, that also drives you crazy about the show is Arya and Bran and Sansa needs to sit in a room for 4 hours with a pot of coffee and say, okay, you tell your story, then I tell my story, then you tell your story. And so we're all on the same page here. And like, we're all on the same team. Everybody else outside of this room is not on Team Stark. And they haven't done that.
Could that be what ends up resolving it when Arya has Sansa on the ground with a knife to her throat, Valyrian steel dagger to her throat?
I don't know. I mean,
this is that contrived thing again, but I feel like they needed Arya and Sansa and Littlefinger to kind of be on pause for a while the Jon, Dany, Cersei business kind of plays out. And so they brought them and Bran all together at Winterfell, and they're giving them a little thing to run around in circles with.
No, I think this is not pause. I think this is it. Like, I think this is kind of Littlefinger's last play, and it's going to go how it goes, and it's either, you know, Arya and Sansa are going to be a team at the end of this, or Arya's going to leave.
Well, they did set it up. Now, here's again, I don't want to keep hitting the contrive button, but I think it's fair to say, and I think ahead, like, what are they trying to do here? So when they did the scene where Arya goes to Sansa this past week and calls her out, right? You like this. You want to be Queen of the North. You don't want Jon to come back. You're thinking about it. I mean, our first thought is, well, dang, Arya, that's a little unfair. You don't know what Sansa's really thinking. But if you think of it in terms of what use did that serve to the larger story, then in my opinion, here's why they did that. I think it was a little out of character for Arya, although maybe not entirely. That soon, okay? But you do it so that when Arya confronts Sansa with this note, it's not the first time she's gone off on her. You know what I mean? In other words, they've already established that Arya is not happy with Sansa's attitude and behavior. Then she gets more ammunition.
And I think we need to step back and look at, like, so Arya hasn't been living among civilized people for a long time.
Right.
You know, she was basically been on the streets, been on the run, and been living, you know, day to day with the threat of being killed and killing other people for years. And so she comes home, and so suddenly she's in her house where she grew up, and her big sister, who she didn't get along with, is in charge, and she immediately falls back into this little sister feeling, this rut. And so I think that to me, that was what kind of played into it. Like, she fell into this, I'm the little sister, I don't like you. And she thinks of Sansa as the same girl that she was when she left. And Sansa, like, dressing up and being the princess and all that kind of stuff. And she thinks Sansa's doing that instead of leading and ruling, which is what Sansa's doing.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. That's right. I've never been a huge Sansa fan, but I totally will give her the credit that she is due for how she's grown up. And she really, I mean, it helps that she's 8 feet tall. She's almost as tall as freaking Brienne. But she has, you know, several people have remarked, you know, you do this part really well. You know, I'm talking about you're the Lady of Winterfell. You do that well. She looks like the Lady of Winterfell. She looks like she should be running that place. You know, Arya doesn't remotely look like she should be the Lady of Winterfell and be running that place, you know. So, and all the stuff that she's gone through, yeah, has made her not the little girl that plays with dolls and dreams of a prince. Because if there's ever been a royal woman, and I mean, there have been plenty in history and real life, but if there's been a royal woman that wanted to marry the fair prince, like in Disney, and instead gets oddball after weirdo after rapist after, you know, I mean, she's...
monster.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, she's really... she's hit 0 for 1,000, you know, on the old who you're marrying thing, so... And the guy that's slavering over her shoulder wanting to marry her is in some ways possibly as bad or, well, I don't know if he's as bad as Ramsay, but he's up there, you know. He has his problems. So she's going to end up like Queen Elizabeth, not marrying anybody, just saying, like, forget men, you know. I can't find one that's not a problem. So I can't imagine who's left on the show that she would marry that would make sense. I don't know who's left that she could. There's not many people left.
No.
Yeah, I mean, what other house?
Dickon would have been good.
Yeah, because he seemed like a good guy. That's the Tarly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That would have been a good match, but unfortunately, he's now burnt toast. So. Anything else?
I want to say one more thing about Arya.
Yeah.
The Brienne fighting scene is important because in the pecking order of, like, badasses in Westeros, Brienne is probably, Brienne and Jon Snow are like 1 and 1A right now. And Brienne beat the Hound. You know, Jaime's got his hand cut off. He's not that good. So I think she's better than Bronn. So I really think, like, you know, if you're standing on even keel with her, you're showing everybody, like, that you're one of the most dangerous people in the whole world.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm clearly Arya is being set up as a weapon, and we know who she wants to aim at. What remains to be seen is who she's actually going to be fired at or fire herself at, and that's really going to be interesting. I mean, that's the thing we're all waiting for. It's all nice. It's well and good that she's being reunited with her family, and we're happy about that. And we're still looking forward to her seeing Jon again. But what really is going to matter for Arya is who is under her Valyrian steel dagger in the last couple of episodes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what face is she wearing? Because I'm ready for her to slap a face on again. I mean, a lot of people are hoping it'll be Littlefinger's.
Well, I wanted her to do that when she was following Littlefinger around. Like, that would just make it, I mean, why are you following him around in your regular face where he can, you know, he may not be able to recognize you the other way, so...
Oh, that's true. Yeah, she could have at least put on some random, like, the waif's face or something. And
yeah.
And if he looked at her, say, oh, sorry, governor, I'm just cleaning up the bedpans, eh? What? You know, as he shuffles by, yeah. That's interesting. We don't know if she... Does she have to kill somebody before she gets their face?
We don't know the things.
We don't know how it works, right? We don't understand it. Okay. Let's see. One more. We'll take our little quick break. Bran. Bran is the... I like how somebody put it on one of the shows this morning I listened to. Bran is the internet. he's Westeros AT&T now. He connects all the modems of Middle Earth of Westeros. Sometimes he's more human. Like, oh boy, send the ravens. You know, we got trouble coming. Other times he's not remotely human at all. Like, well, I guess you won't need me anymore. Yeah, you're right. Go. What? The way he treated Mira, I mean...
It was terrible.
It was mechanical. It was like he was a robot.
Yes. That's what he is basically now. He's the weirwood information machine.
Yeah. Yeah, and have we seen the last of Mira?
I don't think so.
Are we going to see her dad?
Maybe.
Because her dad was one of the guys that was at the Tower of Joy, right?
Right. So he's one of the few people that can, you know, help confirm the story that, you know, that Sam overheard, basically, but didn't pay attention to.
What's his name? I keep wanting to call him Howlin' Wolf.
But Howland Reed.
See, if he had intermarried with the Starks, he would be Howlin' Wolf.
Oh, good gosh.
Yeah, so Howlin' Reed. So Yeah, so we're still kind of got them on pause. We're waiting to see what'll happen with her, what'll happen with her dad. We may not ever see them again. I mean, I'm sure they'll turn up again in the books, if there are books. But we don't know about the show. But what do you think about Bran otherwise? I mean, he obviously served a very important purpose there in giving the warning that the White Walkers are closing in on. And I got to be honest with you, I was afraid they were going to show Jon and his crowd, the Magnificent Seven or whatever they are, Snow's 11. I was afraid that they were going to show them get to Eastwatch, and Eastwatch was going to be like all the be deserted and all the Tormund's people turned into White Walkers.
Mm-hmm. Or under desperate attack already.
Yeah, because I'm like, what good did it do to send Tormund and seven or eight guys up there to Eastwatch? Or how many? I mean,
I think Tormund
that,
took a couple hundred wildlings.
But what are they supposed to do?
They're holding the castle.
Good luck.
But the White Walkers themselves can't cross the wall, so you just have to stop the dead people.
Right. Okay. Well, but now. Well, that's coming up here. So thoughts about Bran?
I mean, he's serving his purpose. He's being the information thing. He saw where the enemy was, and he pointed it out to Jon. And I think that's his role for the rest of the show, basically. It'd be more useful if, like, Sansa could go in and ask him, like, okay, what is Littlefinger plotting right this second? And get that answer, but I don't think he works like that.
Well, he is in a position to confirm Jon's heritage at some point.
Yes.
And so, by the way, so could have been Sam. Did you about, like, fall out of your chair?
Oh, yeah. No, I was freaking out.
Okay, we'll get to that in part E. All right. So, any other thoughts about Bran? I mean, he's really basically at this point a story device. He's not really a character anymore.
And the lack of humanity is... I mean, a little over the top in the show, I think. Yeah. And it's disturbing to watch, you know, but.
Does he have any other big major thing coming, or is he just going to be like the Oracle until the end of the show?
I think that's it for him.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's not.
Here's the other only thing I can say is maybe he could warg into a dragon.
That could be interesting. Yeah, maybe so. We have to take a break for just a second to thank our sponsors, who are the fine folks who are our listeners, people like you. You guys keep us going and keep us on the air. We really, really appreciate it, and we need more. We need to make sure. I was just paying some bills for the web hosting yesterday, which kind of bottomed out the cash reserves. But I went ahead and got like a yearly plan. We were on monthly there for a while, but I got us a yearly plan. But that was a chunk of change. So every bit that you guys contribute helps a little bit toward defraying the costs of keeping our stuff going. By the way, John, before I get into the name of the patrons, I'm in the process right now of really, really updating the websites for White Rocket Entertainment and for myself. I'm going to try to create us one central hub that will have the AU Wishbone, the White Rocket podcast, and the James Bond podcast, Game of Thrones stuff. It'll have our books. It'll have like a comment section board, whatever. I'm trying to set up a deal that's going to have like a one-stop shop for everything that you would want from White Rocket and from you and me and Jared and our other various contributors to our little family. So... as soon as I can figure out WordPress, which I'm like, it bills itself as, any idiot can just drag and drop a website together. And I spent 2 hours and changed one thing and went, well, I'm not just any idiot, apparently. I'm a special idiot because I couldn't do anything with it. So, but we'll have that up soon, I hope. I'll have to get some help. But I want to thank our patrons. If you go to patreon.com, patreon.com, and I'll have a big link to that when we get the new webpage going, as well as a link to our various Kickstarters and whatever. go to patreon.com and it's / Van Allen Plexico, or you can just go to patreon.com and search Plexico, P-L-E-X-I-C-O, and you should find it no problem. We always have to thank, of course, Nicholas Cottrell, and then David Medinas, Mark Squire, Dave Powell, Jared Albrick, Rich Reimer, Michael Kirshner, Bill Matthews, Joey Miller, Matthew Wagstaff, Chris Thrash, Wes Atkinson, J.W. Rice, Randall Walker, our newest member, Richard Stevens, and last but not least, Phil M. Thor of WeHaveDonuts.com. If you're in the Alabama area and you want awesome homemade donuts, go to WeHaveDonuts.com. They're all over Birmingham available, and they also have occasional runs to other cities. So good Auburn people that we are good type, very proud to have associated with us. So thanks to all you folks for helping us. And our list is getting nice and long there, which really, really helps. But we've still got a ways to go before I'm comfortable. Okay, John went down to Dragonstone. And we've talked about a little of this periphery already, but the main things, what I want to know, John, is he left, right? He left to go to the wall with, as you put it, the Westeros All-Stars, or I said the John's 11. Did he take any of the dragon glass?
No, that would have been a good thing to take, obviously, if you're going to face the White Walkers. Maybe they did. Maybe they had bags of it and arrowheads of it that they didn't show. But it wouldn't have been that hard to say, hey, here's the box of dragon glass we're bringing with us. And, you know, on the way, we got this armor who could make some stuff out of it. But I think what they did is they're setting up a process for the mining of the dragon glass, and then they're going to ship it up to Winterfell and the wall, basically, you know, as time moves along. So I think basically they set up the process for that, but they don't have a bunch of dragon glass yet.
Now you say that, but what do you bet that, like, the first scene of Sunday's episode will be them all, like, in a boat on the way up to the, well, no, they've already gone out, haven't they?
They're already there.
Oh, crap.
But they may be like, okay, time to pass out the dragon glass.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, John doesn't need it because he's got that sword that is made out of Valyrian steel, which apparently works the same way. But everybody else needs it, right? So I would think Jorah would have some kind of fancy sword, but maybe not. I don't know.
His dad had it. That's what John has.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's right. Okay. So we don't know exactly what's going on with the dragon glass. We assume he left some people behind to mine it. What do you think about the cave paintings? Like, it was like the Neanderthal, you know, or the Cro-Magnon paintings in France, at that are so famous. It, or something out of Prometheus, where you had the spirals and the wavy lines and all, and then the little drawing of the army of the undead, which I thought was, you have sun, wavy lines, army of the undead.
I mean, and you talked about the connective tissue, and this is one that was a little too easy.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, really? You need to convince her they're real, and there's on the island, there's a drawing that some ancient people did of these guys, and it's, I don't know.
And like an arrow pointing at the dragon glass mound and exclamation points.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
the pictures of dragon glass hitting them and they're falling down.
Yes, exactly. Right. Oh, man. But somebody on one of the other shows said maybe John painted those really quickly and then went and grabbed Danny. Come look at this.
I signed it. That crossed my mind.
Like it said JS at the bottom, you know.
I know John would never do that, but it was a little too convenient.
It was exceptionally convenient. We've heard tell, because again, we've talked about the main thing already, which is John felt like he couldn't take the knee to her, and she felt like she had to demand it, and you're kind of at an impasse. We've already talked about that. But what about this talk that there's been a little buzz about, that there's a romance brewing between John and Dany? Now, when I first heard that after episode 3 or maybe 4, I'm like, I don't really feel any chemistry between them. But I felt like there was a little bit in 5 in Eastwatch. What do you think about that?
I think in the cave scene, there was some chemistry. on John's side, and in the most recent episode, there was some chemistry on Danny's side until Jorah showed up.
So I think
the Jorah thing really threw water on it. But I think until then, there was some chemistry building between them. Because the other option, besides bending the knee, is they get married.
Right, and that's what a lot of people kind of suspect.
The obvious arc kind of is, but...
Yeah. Even though he's her nephew. Which is weird.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. You know, that's the one character from the books that you never even really see in the books that I really think is interesting and fascinating that I'd like to see is Rhaegar. Because when you first encounter him in the first book, he's always mentioned like he's a villain, like he's this horrible... You know, I was always picturing like Conan the Barbarian or something that Robert had to fight with his hammer. But the more you learn about him, you know, the more you realize he was actually probably a much cooler guy than Robert.
Yes.
And would have been fascinating to get to know. He was a scholar, you know, and a musician and everything. And, I mean, he didn't look like a big barbarian. He probably looked like a bigger version of Dany and her brother that we saw in the first season. So, kind of like a big elf almost, you know, from Lord of the Rings. So, he's a fascinating character. And that's John's dad, more or less, right?
Yes.
Though there's still talk that Tyrion is part Targaryen, though to me that kind of stretches the whole business. If everybody turns out to be everybody's cousin, I mean, it kind of, yeah, you know what I mean?
Do you think? No, but I buy that Tyrion is a secret Targaryen theory.
You think he is?
Yes.
So everybody's related?
There's three dragons. People got to ride them. It's going to be the three of them.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes people are like, oh, it's too easy. But sometimes it's too easy.
Yeah. It wouldn't be any more contrived than a lot of stuff that they... I wonder if some of that is why Martin's having such a hard time with the books now, because he realizes that some of the things that were very pat and easy when he was only writing like three books start seeming a little... pulled thin when you get to book 7 or 8, you know, or 6 or 7 or whatever. I just wonder if maybe when he first dreamed it all up, he thought, well, this guy's a cousin, then she's a cousin, and they all find out at the end. And then when he actually starts writing it all, he's like, oh, that's a little too pat, you know what I mean?
Well, but in the book there's fake cousins and that kind of stuff too, so he's throwing them off the scent with that already. But
yeah, that's true. Yeah, when you got a whole lot more chaff in the air, then 2 or 3 is not that big of a deal. But on the TV show, that's all we're seeing. So it would be like 100% turn out to be long-lost cousin or something. Well, anyway.
People who have touched dragons and not died in this show are Dany, Tyrion, and Jon.
And Jon. Right. And we know all the stuff like Tyrion... dreamed about dragons and was sad when he found out that they didn't live anymore, as far as anybody knew. And he has the mismatched eyes, and he has the blonder hair than everybody else, allegedly. And so, and his mother apparently was either having an affair or a rape by or some combination thereof of the king, right?
Yes. Now,
what was the deal? What was the deal with the Targaryens that they were just getting with everybody's wives?
Some of them weren't nice people.
Yeah. Well, clearly, Ned's sister really did care about Rhaegar.
We're learning that now. I mean, there, for a long time,
it was just rape.
The theory was it was rape.
Right. Now we're finding out they really did have a thing. Because wasn't she supposed to marry Robert? Wasn't that the deal? She was supposed to marry Robert? And because of her dying, it ended up he gets Cersei as his consolation prize. Wow, that really, what a, I know she was attractive and everything, but man, going from Ned's probably very nice sister to Cersei Lannister.
And just think about all the bad things that happened as a result of that.
Yeah, that's really where things kind of started going bad in some ways. There's a lot of places where things started going bad. Well, the other thing, you mentioned Gendry, And I did you expect to see him again?
I mean, unfortunately, I had seen somewhere a picture that he was back this season, so I did expect him back. Before that, I would have said no, that he's gone.
Davo says, I thought you're still rowing.
and I did, like, there's a line there with that, but I thought that one was really funny. Yeah. Because the internet has made the rowing joke forever. So I thought that was really funny. And I'm excited Gendry's back. I'm like, he could be the, you know, the Danny or John or whoever could legitimize him, and he could be the Lord of Storm's End. It'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have to be the king. He could just be like
the head of the Baratheon family and Lord of Storm's End. And remember, like, he and Arya kind of dug each other.
Yeah, that's true. That would be interesting. Yeah, because I mean, the Baratheons were only—they're jumped up. I mean, they have, don't they have some minor connection to the Targaryens through the previous generation that made them the most appropriate to take over when they killed the Mad King? But still, they're not—they're not the royal family. They're just like—I mean, they're like if the Nevilles took over after the War of the Roses, you know, Wars of the Roses, after the Yorks and Lancasters are done. They're like the next one, you know. I mean, they're not as far down as the Tudors, which is ridiculous. But the fact that all this, you know, is based on the Wars of the Roses, and the fact that the Tudors ended up winning the Wars of the Roses, I mean, if this is how truth is stranger than fiction, John. If Game of Thrones wanted to be as ridiculous as real life, then when all this is over, like, the Tarleys would rule Westeros. That's how ridiculous it is that freaking the Tudors won the Wars of the Roses. He was like the stable boy to Henry V's wife. That's where that family came from. But anyway. I wanted to mention his hammer. Gendry's got that awesome hammer. I love that because, I mean, like, you know, I like Warhammer, the books. And so he rolls out that big Warhammer. You're like, suddenly I realize how effective a Warhammer actually is. You know, you hear Warhammer and you think Thor. And then you think, other than Thor, how much use is a hammer really in war? You can stop and build a little building in the middle of the fight, but man, that thing messed some people up.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm excited to see him use it.
Just something different.
Yeah.
I get the feeling, and did you see I don't know how you watch it. I watch it on HBO now, so I get to see the little 5-minute long thing with Benioff and Weiss at the end.
I don't ever watch that.
Oh man, you got to watch those. They explain. They help a lot. We watch them. But anyway, well, one of the things that they explain this time, they explained two things that I thought were really useful. They explained how, I mean, they just flat out said, just to make, because I'm kind of dense sometimes, but they flat out said Littlefinger is making his big gambit to turn Arya against Sansa. So if there was ever any doubt about that, and that he planned it all on purpose, and he did it all, and I believe that what either Benioff or Weiss said was, Littlefinger is leading her around by the nose.
Yes.
The other thing that was useful that they said was that they didn't flat say they weren't planning to bring Gendry back, but here's what they said. They said, Davos had to take Tyrion to King's Landing. Right? He's the one who had to do it. Mm-hmm. And they said, all right, so Tyrion goes off to meet Jaime. Is Davos going to sit there and twiddle his thumbs till Tyrion gets back? And they said, no, he needs to go do something. What can he do? Hey, Gendry. So Gendry is back mainly because they needed Davos something to do while waiting with the boat. Okay. What that means to me is, does that mean they're actually going to do something with him now they've got him back? Or was that his entire purpose and now he can just kind of be a red shirt?
I think he's probably cannon fodder.
But. Oh, man. All right. Well, how long does he last? One more episode? Does he get killed by the White Walkers in a brave display as he hammers?
I don't think all of Jon's all-stars are coming back.
No, I doubt that. Well, all right. John's coming back. Davos didn't even go. I love how Davos is like, I'm old and feeble. You don't need me there. And they're like, yeah, you're right about that. And he's like, well, you didn't have to agree. So Davos is safe. John is coming back, obviously.
Tormund is coming back.
Tormund has got to come back because he's got to see the big woman again. Jorah has been through too much to die doing this, surely. Right?
I don't know.
Oh, he's...
What if Jorah is the white?
No, he's already been the stone man. He don't turn... he doesn't come down with every malady in Westeros, surely. Maybe Gendry. Maybe that's his purpose. The hammer-wielding zombie. I mean, who else is there? There's Jon, Tormund, Gendry.
Well, and then the Hound and Thoros of Myr and
Dondarrion.
Dondarrion. Beric Dondarrion.
Who got... did you see the previews?
I did.
We get the flaming sword.
I love the flaming sword.
It looked pretty awesome in the snow. I have to say, Dondarrion is a cool dude when he gets it going, when he's not just sitting around drinking or dying and coming back to life.
And that I heard a great theory about him going north of the wall. Did you hear this?
Fired up. No pun intended.
All right. This is in the speculation realm. They go north of the wall, and Dondarrion, it looks like some of them are going to die. The Hound dies, and Dondarrion is dying, and he tells Thoros of Myr, don't bring me back, bring the Hound back. So the Hound comes back instead of, and Dondarrion is dead now. And so the Hound is basically brought back by the Red God, the Fire God, and so he is basically undead, just like his brother is.
Oh!
So when we get Clegane Bowl, they're both undead zombies.
It's undead Clegane Bowl.
And they literally like can't be killed.
So it could go on forever. Eternal undead Clegane Bowl.
They'll be like chopping each other's, arms off and still fighting.
It'll be like the Black Knight and Monty Python.
It will. It'll be just like that.
Two little fingers jabbing each other. There'll be thumbs literally thumb wrestling.
So I really liked that theory when I heard it. I was like, I could go for that.
Man. All right. Let's see what else we got. Sam heals. All right, we haven't had a chance to talk about this. We had that utterly, utterly gross scene where Sam finishes healing Jorah, and he's healed up pretty well, it looks like. He's good to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sam's done a lot of good stuff. And then Sam tries to convince the Maesters about the White Walkers and that you can trust Jon and you can trust Bran and everything. I mean, I kind of understand why they don't want to believe it, because it is kind of far-fetched. If I were one of these rulers, the further south you go, the less likely I'd be to believe any of this stuff. Even though they do have dragons, so maybe, that's not the only supernatural-seeming thing. But finally, Sam gets fed up, packs up his growing boy and Gilly in the wagon with a stash full of stolen scrolls, right?
Yep.
He's got half the country after it. He's got stolen scrolls from the Citadel, and he's got the stolen sword. Of course, nobody cares now that the sword is gone.
That's right. Everybody who cared is dead.
Except, I guess, his mother or his sister or whatever, right?
They don't care.
Yeah. They probably are glad he has it, because at least he has it. I don't know. But
so Sam is Lord of Hornhill now. But he took the black and renounced his land, so he can't be that, but he would be. So maybe his son is?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that little kid. Isn't that one of Craster's boys?
It is. But but Sam could drop them off there when he goes north, and now if he finds out his dad and brother are dead, he could take them home and say, okay, my son's the next lord, y'all take care of him. I'll be back when the bad stuff happens. You stay down here in the south.
And there won't be anybody there to torture them like there were the last time.
Mm-hmm.
The mom and the sister were all right with him, weren't they? It was the dad that
was the dad that was terrible to Gilly. So.
Right. Well, he's not going to be terrible to anybody anymore. So the big thing there is as Sam is getting fed up and deciding to pack up and like the Beverly Hillbillies and head north, Gilly is reading from some book and she says, "What's an annulment?" And I'm like, "Oop!" My antenna went up, right? But of course Sam is like, I don't know, I'm so pissed off. And she's like, "Oh well, this guy Rhaegar got an annulment from his wife and married this person and had a baby or something." And I'm like, "Oh my gosh. Secret marriage in Dorne."
Huge, huge news.
That is big. Did we know that from the books?
No. We did not know. We knew Jon was their son.
Right.
Like we got to that point, but we didn't know he was legitimate.
Right. So
they were married and he was the rightful heir, and he is.
Instead of a Stark bastard, he's a Targaryen heir. Now here's the thing, because I was talking about this with my wife, who's big into English history even more than me, you know, this whole period that this is based on. And I'm like, all right, here was the deal. Just bear with me here for just a second, John, because this is going to set it up. In Henry V, okay, Henry, who is a Lancaster, by the way, on that side of the Plantagenet dynasty, he asserts that he has the right to rule France, not just England. And the French say, no, you don't. Our current king has his side of the family, because the Plantagenets were all half tied into the French going back to Norman conquest, okay? And they say, no, he's not. Our French king is in charge because the rule can only pass through the male side of the family. And the whole argument of Henry V and his invasion of France leading up to Agincourt, right? The whole argument was that Henry and the English said French law allows it to pass through the female. And the French said, no, there's this thing called the Salic Law that says only through the male line can the heir succeed, okay? So what that means is if they've got the Salic Law in Westeros, then John is the legitimate heir, not Danny, because he's the first male going down the line. But if they don't have that sort of Salic Law, then Dany is the heir because she's a generation older than Jon. So they each have a 100% legitimate claim depending on how the law works. Now, what do you think about that?
I think that kind of stuff is nice if there's a bunch of lawyers talking about it, but there's not.
Right.
You know, it's like she's got the army, so her claim is valid.
Well, when they get married... And see, we've established Targaryens don't have a whole lot of problem marrying each other, just like, you know, Jaime and Cersei. So if the two of them did get together and get married, though part of it would be kind of, there would definitely be no doubt that they together had the right to rule, would there?
That's fair.
And I mean, why would you hint at a romance if they're not?
But I think that kind of thinking, like... one of the things that Game of Thrones does is kind of throw all that out and show like, oh, that's nice, but I got the army, so your claim's worth the paper it's written on. So.
Yeah, but I mean, if Dany and Jon got together, that would unite the Targaryens and the Starks.
Let's look at it another way. If they don't get together, but this truth comes out, is Dany going to go, oh, you're the king, I'm not?
No.
So.
No, she's not. Yeah, there's absolutely no way after everything she's been through, Dany's going to get to the very threshold of victory, and then Bran's going to say, oh, he has a better claim than you. She's going to be like, oh, I'm sorry. I'll just step entirely aside and let this dude from the north take the throne instead of me. Yeah, forget everything I've done my entire life, you know, to build up to this. I'll just hand it all over to you because this kid... in a wheelchair, and I think it's neat that they have medieval wheelchairs, basically says that I'm supposed to. Where are they going with this then?
I mean, they're trying to prove who he is and that he's legitimate.
But what's the end game with that? That he's going to be the king? That she's going to be the queen? Are they going to get together? I mean, what's the end point of knowing that he is what he is?
The end point is that he's not who he thinks he is. Yeah. I mean, his whole life has been defined by I'm a bastard.
Okay.
I'm illegitimate. I'm not. I want to be a Stark, but I'm not a Stark. But really, he belonged to, he was the legitimate son of this other family.
So is he going to press
the end game?
Is he going to press his claim and say, "I'm king of Westeros, the Iron Throne"?
No, he's not worried about any of that. He's worried about stopping the White Walkers.
I mean, once that's over, once everybody lives happily ever after, is he just going to say, "Well, I should be king, but unlike everybody else with the slightest claim to it, I'm just going to walk away from it"?
I'm not sure he's going to go that long.
Okay. I'm just wondering, they've spent so much time over the years setting up this whole thing where Jon is a Targaryen, and they even went out of their way this episode to show that he's a legitimate Targaryen. I just feel like that's all leading somewhere, and not just his peace of mind. I mean, it's leading somewhere concrete, I feel like.
I think it's leading to him being able to ride a dragon and roast White Walkers with it. That's my theory, but...
All right. We'll see. Okay. I just feel like they're going somewhere with it beyond that. I think that's all a means to an end, and I want to know where the end is. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
That's what I'm thinking. Okay. Let's see. Last couple of things. Cersei. We talked about the mercenaries already that she's thinking about hiring, which that should be interesting. Cersei is pregnant?
Yeah. Do you buy it?
Yeah, why not? I mean, I don't love it, but I mean, I don't think she's a legitimate ruler of Westeros anyway, so what difference does it make? The Lannisters have no claim to the throne, and she wasn't even, her kids weren't even Baratheon, so it's like if
This is a legalistic thing again. She's on the throne. She has the army and she has King's Landing. She's the ruler.
And she blew everybody up. That's
right. She outmaneuvered everybody.
I love
how. She's been doing it to Dany a lot so far.
Oh, one of my favorite moments. Gilly, how many windows does this great Sept of Baelor have? None. That was great. None anymore. So what is that going to mean then that Cersei's... Possibly. You think she's not pregnant?
I don't know. It was like, really? But I mean, I think it's also like, I don't know how to feel about Jaime. And to me, it's all relative to Jaime. He's the character I'm interested in here.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think Cersei's evil and manipulative and, you know, she's trying to make sure that Jaime's doing what she wants him to do.
So she's lying.
I don't think she's... She probably is pregnant. It's certainly possible, obviously, but...
I hope they got good neonatal care in King's Landing.
She's got Qyburn, so...
Oh, God! Oh, no!
That's her neonatal
That's like saying,
care.
Well, she's got Dr. Frankenstein there, so, you know...
That's right.
He's a good doctor. He is Dr. Frankenstein. Clearly, he's probably got an MD in... creating monsters and neonatal intensive care. I'm sure those are the two things he specialized in when he got his MD, you know, from the Citadel. So, oh gosh. Well, that's Cersei. What do you think of, is it unrealistic that she's just suddenly turned into this tactical genius after being completely, I mean, I read A Feast for Crows, and about half of A Feast for Crows, book four, about half of that book is look how incompetent Cersei is when she's in charge. So how did we go from Cersei being utterly incompetent and ruining everything to in one fell swoop she blows up the Great Sept of Baelor and becomes a tactical genius outsmarting Tyrion and Dany?
I mean, two things. One is, I don't think she's that much of a genius. I think she just kind of got the jump on him because, you know, she knew what she needed to do and did it. But also, I think, I mean, she's still motivated by the same things that always motivate her, like hate and revenge. She'd much rather, you know, kill Tyrion painfully than win, I think, sometimes. So, but also, it's this mercenary thing is a perfect example. That's a bad idea. Okay, the mercenaries cannot be trusted, and the Golden Company is in the history of the books, you know, founded by the bastard children of the Targaryen family. So they could turn on her. I mean, they Golden Company's reputation is they don't turn on people, their word is good, and they don't break their contracts. But you can't trust mercenaries, and it would be the kind of thing where she brought them over, put them in a position of power, and then they were like, oh man, Danny's got the dragons, we're with her.
Yeah.
So that would be the kind of Cersei move that you're thinking of from the books and the earlier seasons, where she was an idiot about this stuff. But some of it is, you know, in the show and in the books, characters learn and develop. And I think her suffering at the hands of the High Septon, you know, and what she had to endure there really taught her some stuff about how to handle her enemies, where she was not going to be as stupid as she was before that.
Well, and also, also her friends, because think about this. When she had her first go, she had the small council, and they were pretty much all idiots. Except for Littlefinger, who was a self-serving jerk and was really undermining her, and everybody else was an idiot. Now her two and Jaime wasn't even hardly around then. Remember, Jaime was off on missions. Her two main advisors now are Jaime and Qyburn, right?
Yep.
And they both.
Qyburn's competent.
I was going to say
she's learned not to surround herself with these fops and sycophants. That she has some competent people advising her.
Right. No, I think that she's definitely in creepier but better hands, or in Jamie's case, hand, than she was before. Yeah, and that makes a big difference. And I haven't heard that talked about. I haven't heard that addressed by anybody.
But it's also like even simple things like her physical security. She's not leaving the Red Keep, and she's not going 10 feet without the dead mountain with her.
So, yeah, before she thought she could still live like before Robert died, where she's, you know, I'm the queen, everybody loves me, I can just do this and that. Now
nobody will lay a finger on me.
Yeah, now she's really being more realpolitik, you know, she's staying holed up, she's on a defensive mindset. Instead of an entitled mindset, she's much more like, I know everybody hates me, I'm ruling with an iron fist, and they just gonna have to deal with it, yeah.
She's I'm not going to put myself in a position of vulnerability either.
You know, it is fascinating. I mean, one of the things that's great about the books and this show is the characters and how they change and grow, right? I mean, that's one of the things that's absolutely impeccable about this story, is how those characters change and grow. And more than most things, how the women characters change and grow. I mean, it really has, except for Jon and Tyrion, this really has been a story of how women have dealt with this whole situation. And honestly, as much as we despised so much about Cersei, she really has learned and grown, maybe in some dark ways, but, you know, I mean, we root against her as like one of the main villains, but, you know, honestly, in terms of a character in the story, she really has grown and changed and evolved quite a bit. It's been fascinating. She's not a good character, but she's a good character. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Our last bullet point. Okay. Is the big plan, as you put it, the Westeros All-Stars. I'm going to lump this two together here because it's really one thing. They decide, Jon and company decide, we need to convince Cersei, and maybe Dany too along the way, of the seriousness of this threat. And if we can't take Cersei up above the wall and show her, let's bring zombies down in a box and show her the zombie in a box, which entails going up and finding them, which does not sound like a good idea, and trying to capture one. And it just sounds like a terribly bad idea all the way around. They're all like, oh, this is a great idea. Yes, this is perfect. Why didn't we think of this before? Let's do that. And I'm sitting there going, this is a terrible idea. You're all going to die. This is nothing good's going to come of this.
But it's also a terrible idea because the whole point of the idea is to get Cersei to care about other human beings.
And that was my other point. Does anybody really think, even if you shipped by FedEx a box containing a zombie with the note that said, a million of these are coming toward the wall, Cersei's going to be like, oh, good, maybe it'll kill all my enemies. Does anybody really think she's going to give a flip about this and want to do?
No, she's going to look at Qyburn and go, figure out a way we can control these guys.
Yeah.
Or we'll just let them kill. I mean, here's the, you could see it coming 100 miles away, and I hope this isn't the way it goes.
Right.
But she agreed. You know, they go through this struggle, and there's all this, a bunch of people die, and they bring the white down there, and they show it to her, and she's like, okay, we'll need an armistice. And then she uses the time in the armistice to prepare for her big backstab on Danny, and then pulls it off. I mean, that's 100% where this is going, and I hate it because the whole idea is stupid. The idea that you – and then, like, I don't understand why Tyrion is going along with this. Like, the idea that you could show Cersei white, and she's like, okay, I'll be honorable now, is a bunch of crap.
Plus, they just destroyed her army. What exactly army are they hoping to get from her that'll help?
That's the thing. Like, they should go the other way and try and end the war quickly by taking King's Landing right now.
Yeah.
And not, you know, do the silliness with the white thing.
Well, that's the thing. John is so hung up, and I understand why. I don't blame him, but John is so hung up on, we've got to go fight the White Walkers now, that maybe there is more wisdom in what Danny's saying, which is, let's go conquer the freaking country and then swing around and take out, you know, have our unified army, our unified kingdom take out the big enemy, rather than blowing away half our army against the White Walkers and then handing the whole country over to her. Because if you fail and the White Walkers beat your whole army and your dragons, Danny's not going to beat them.
That's right.
So, yeah, I get their tactics, but I question their overall strategy.
Yeah, I feel the strategy is stupid.
They're proceeding from some very shaky assumptions and plans, I feel like, yeah. So, but what do you think is going to come of them going up above the wall in a more specific way? Like, are we going to see a big throwdown with the whites and everything next episode?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's going to be a big battle. Some of them are going to die. Some of them are going to make it, and some of them aren't. We've already kind of walked through that, and then they're going to get theoretically get away with a white. who else is north of the wall that might come on to help them?
Oh, Benjen?
Benjen. Cold Hands might show up and give him a hand.
Cold Hand? Cold Hand Luke?
So, that's possible.
Yeah.
But otherwise, say they, you know, some of them live and they get away with the white, and then they, you know, tie them up with a bunch of chains and put them in a box and, you know, take them to King's Landing. The other thing is, when they take them to King's Landing, are they expecting there to be, like, John and Danny go to King's Landing with him?
I can't even imagine. Who are they going to send?
I can't send Tyrion.
No.
Because they would just be like, oh, that's great, kill him. So who's going to go, and you're going to send Davos? And Cersei's like, I'm not talking to this guy.
Or Tormund.
That's what I'm saying. You can't send Tormund either.
He'd just be walking around looking at the buildings and going, golly!
You going to send Jorah Mormont again? Like, is he going to be the envoy? He and Davos are going to go tell the story? So that's the whole thing is like, and if Jon and Dany go, Cersei would be like, aha, kill them. You know, so...
I mean, I feel like they didn't. I would say they didn't think this thing through. Except we watched them think it through and ignore all these critical points.
That's right.
Oh gosh!
And this is the woman who blew up the church with all her enemies in it, and you think like you're gonna, you know, she's gonna suddenly see reason and care about humanity. I just, that part really bothers me.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you think will be our big finale, our big cliffhanger for the end of the season?
Good question.
2 weeks. We got a little less than 2 weeks on that.
I mean, a big battle north of the wall. You know, Arya, Sansa shakedown. Maybe the beginning of the siege of King's Landing, but they're not going to do that if they do this armistice thing. So maybe, I mean, I can't imagine they end the. So say this episode they get the white and get back to the wall,
okay.
Right. That 90% of the episode is action north of the wall. They get the white, they get back to the wall, and then the next episode, they set up the truce meeting and they meet with Cersei on some neutral ground on some island or something. And Daenerys and Jon show up with Cersei and they show her the white. Like, is that? And they're like, okay, armistice against the whites. And so that's the end of the season. Like, next season, it's all humans against the evil.
No. You know, here's the speed they've been going at. Here's the speed they've been going at with these last episodes. I agree with you that next episode will end with them capturing a white. Some of them are dead, some of them are alive, and they get back with it, or they leave with it. I feel like, like you said, the last episode is they'll try to broker a deal with Cersei. They'll meet. And, you know, here's what's going to happen. They're going to – here's which could happen, fitting their speed or their timetable. It's going to end either with Cersei breaking the truce and trying to kill them all, and the cliffhanger will be who's dead, and Cersei standing over them laughing, which will lead us right into season 8 or whatever, 7, whatever it is. Or at the very end, let's say they have 2 or 3 whites. The whites get loose and start eating people.
The other cliffhanger I could see for this season is like the whites getting past the wall. That would be a great season number.
They've been putting that off, yeah.
Suddenly they're past the wall and they're surrounding, you know, Winterfell or whatever.
They keep pushing that and pushing it like it's taking they're taking the long walk around. They're on Mao's long march, you know. They're just taking their blessed time. It's like the king, it's like the Winter King or whatever his name is. He's like, hold on, man. I can see the wall. Back, back, back. They turn around and march back a little bit more, and they're like, all right, now let's try it again, you know. Because they're wanting to get there just at the end of the season, and it's like, you know, it takes them longer to walk 20 miles to the wall than it's taking some characters in this show to go from King's Landing to Dragonstone to Highgarden, to here, to there. I mean, they are some slow zombies.
Yeah, no, and we need to move faster because they can't take 6 months to get from where they are to the wall.
Right, and then 2 episodes to get from there to, like, King's Landing.
Yeah.
So, Any last? Did we get any listener questions? Do you know?
We got one.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
The listener question is from Patrick J. Williams, who says,
"Yeah,
does the Hound die north of the Wall, turn white, and get brought back to Cersei for zombie Clegane Bowl?"
There you go.
So his theory is Clegane. You know that the Hound would be the white. And I don't think he's the white. I think he comes back instead of I like this theory. He comes back instead of
Dondarrion. Yeah, I think they're going to do something very convoluted involving the Hound, involving the whites. I mean, they're going to twist
there it should around. There could be your season finale is Clegane Bowl.
Oh, man. Yeah, because the mountain would definitely come with Danny. I mean, come with Cersei if they meet mm-hmm. somewhere. And the Hound could come down as, like, custodian of the... That's why you brought him back in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not just to have that cool flaming sword scene with Dondarrion, but also to...
Well, that's really why, but...
Yeah, I just look for patterns in how they're moving the pieces around. Like, why do you bring this character back in at this point? Because you need him to be here when they do this. Well, why are you doing this? Because you need this to happen. And you it's just interesting. It's like a chess game. You're trying to think 2 or 3 moves ahead. It's fascinating. That's one of the things that makes it so compelling. One of the things that's so compelling about this story, the books and the TV show, is that there are just so many cool chess pieces. It's like, you know, it's like I was describing yesterday on Facebook. I was writing a big military scene in orbit. And I said, I feel like I'm playing 4-dimensional chess with 600 pieces, you know. Well, that's what Game of Thrones is. You're playing this multidimensional chess with all these different pieces that all move independently of each other. And it's utterly fascinating to try to predict where all this is going and what it'll mean. So, Well, I think that gets us to the end of these three episodes. Any last thoughts before we sign off for another great Game of Thrones show? Knowing that we'll be back in 2 weeks to wrap up the last two episodes and wrap up season seven.
No, I mean, this last episode was a little disappointing, but I have to say, before that, yeah, I was on a real high. This is the episodes this season have been, you know, multiple scenes where I was, you know, cheering and yelling and stuff. And the episode before that, where Arya came home and we had the dragons attacking the loot train, was and the Dothraki was just awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, this season and probably next of Game of Thrones kind of reminds me of the fourth season of Babylon 5, where they thought the show was going to get canceled after the fourth season, and so they did everything in the fourth season. Bang, 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 you know. Of course, they ended up getting a fifth season. The fifth season's kind of boring because they did everything in season four.
They played all the cards.
Yeah. Right, exactly. They thought they had to. And so they with this, instead of doing that, they just basically took season four and broke it in half into two half seasons, spread over 2 years. So we're getting, you know, seven now and six next year. I mean, that's really what it is. Season eight is basically just going to be the rest of season seven. They're just doing it over 2 years so they can put more money and more time into each one. And I'm happy with that. I'd rather have seven butt-kicking episodes than 13 mediocre ones, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And a lot, especially next year, what I've heard is the episode's going to be longer. So.
Yeah, yeah, like hour and a half long episodes and stuff. And that's fine. I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, it makes sense that you'd have six episodes so you can put way more money into each one, but there's nothing stopping you from having extra scenes, especially scenes that don't cost a lot, right? I mean, you could have extra scenes with Arya and Littlefinger or something, and that doesn't cost you anything compared
That's right.
Compared to... Oh, and the last thing I want to mention, what character is absolutely MIA, totally missing in action this whole season, that would have been a real help going beyond the wall with the Magnificent?
Oh. Ghost.
Yeah, where is Ghosty? Where is he?
He's got to be at Winterfell.
But, I mean, wouldn't they have taken him past the wall?
Well, I think Jon couldn't take him to meet Daenerys, right? Because you're not going to let a dire wolf loose on the island with the queen or whatever. The Dothraki and them would never stand for that because they don't trust Ghost.
Oh, he'd be a shish kebab by now.
That's right. So... they couldn't bring him, and John didn't go back to Winterfell to get him, so he's not there.
I just miss him. We haven't. Well, the thing is that supposedly the CGI is very expensive, and they had to either do dragons or do Ghost, and so they've been doing the dragons. And I get that, but I still miss Ghost. I love Ghosty. Ghost must be huge by now. Think how big Arya's wolf was.
Yep, Nymeria.
Oh man, Ghost will be like the size of an elephant. Dang, I hope we get him back at some point. Do you think we'll see him again?
Yes.
I hope so. I like Ghost. He's cool. All right, John, I guess we're going to wrap up for another episode. For those that listen to both shows, John and I will be back about a week from now to do the big SEC barbecue preview for the AU Wishbone. So if you like your SEC and college football, be sure to tune in for that on the AU Wishbone feed on iTunes and on Google Play and on podbean.com, P-O-D-B-E-A-N. And we will be back in 2 weeks to finish up season 7 of Game of Thrones. What do we say to death, John?
Not today.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.